Let the spirit of the Kennedys
and the magic of the Disney brothers be with you always.
Blood and Business Legacy merch, available now.
Let's run faster,
work harder,
burn brighter
before we're gone.
Order your Blood and Business Legacy merch today.
Cassie here with a mild trigger warning. I'm going to be using quotes that are word for word from the people and from the time that they were stated. So there might be alarming terms and very harsh words used during these episodes, but I do not want to alter or sugarcoat the history and the way that people were treated. Welcome to Blood and Business.
I'm Bethany.
And I'm Cassie.
Today we're telling a story of siblings born and bred to run the world. They were the most infamous family of the 20th century. Their story drips with conspiracy. Their names whispered through the decades since they left their voices echoing in time and space. Their hands helped mold the America we know, sharing with their country dreams of landing on the moon, freedom for every man. And by example, they inspired generations to reach the highest heights. They played with fire, and only a few survived. Their words ring through our history books, their pretty faces on our television screens, and their signature will forever be stamped on our national identity. They stood in the trenches. We stood beside them. They flashed their diamonds. We flashed our cameras. They had their fun, and we saluted them. They were good. They were evil. They were human. They are
the Kennedy siblings.
On the week before the 1958 Senate election, Massachusetts citizens turned on their television sets and saw "At Home with the Kennedys" stretched across their screens. Rose began with,
"Good morning, friends."
She reminded everyone that they had a similar program 6 years ago when Jack was a Senate candidate and recalled how much
many of you, most of you, I think, seemed to have enjoyed it. So we have arranged to have it again this year. Of course, there have been a great many changes in the family, and we have a charming addition in the presence of Jacqueline, Jack's wife, who has been campaigning with him during the last few months, and whom I know many of you have met.
"I've enjoyed campaigning so much, Mrs. Kennedy,"
Jackie replied in a controlled and graceful tone.
"Your youngest son, Teddy, who, as you know, is campaign manager, set up the schedule for us last summer, and now he joins us whenever he can get away. We visited 184 communities, and I think supped in every city in Massachusetts."
Then Rose asks what the rest of them have been up to that summer. And Jean and Eunice share about all of their houses right in a row in Hyannisport, and that Bobby took all the kids sailing on the Cape, and that the siblings, all being there, had a combined 9 children between the ages of 1 and 7 running around that summer. Another of the big changes Rose was talking about having happened since the last At Home with the Kennedys was Caroline Bouvier Kennedy. She is Jack and Jackie's first child, and she was born on November 27th, 1957, in New York City.
And you may recognize...
I thought you were doing an accent!
And you may...
If you're not watching the video, we have literally white satin gloves on and we just cannot. We looked up an interview of Jackie and oh my goodness, her voice was so proper.
And you may recognize that she is named after a certain aunt of hers, or aunt, if you will, the fabulous Princess Lee.
Right, because Lee was just the nickname that her dad called her by, but her first name was actually Caroline. Caroline was Jack and Jackie's rainbow baby, born just a year after the miscarriage of her older sister, Arabella, in August 1956.
When Jack was unwilling to come home, so Bobby was the one that had to deliver the news to Jackie at the hospital.
As the Kennedy kids became parents themselves, Joe and Rose entered into their grandparent era. And since the Bobby and Ethel fandom is chomping at the bit to get to their story, we must acknowledge that they, with the birth of Kathleen, in one fell swoop, made Joe and Rose grandparents for the first time, as well as gifting them with a living tribute to their lost golden girl. Kick. This At Home with the Kennedys television program was part of the effort behind Jack's 1958 Senate re-election campaign. He had already served 6 years, but he felt that he wasn't quite done yet. In fact, this office was good. He was able to help out the citizens a little. But you know what would really be more effective?
The presidency.
Quote,
"It's quite obvious, and it has been, and I think it's going to be true even more, that all the great decisions which are going to be made, which will affect the lives of everyone in this room now, will be made by the United States government and their allies and the communist governments. The United States is really the only guardian at the gate against the communist advance. The responsibility is heavy on us, and I think that as an interested citizen of the United States, I cannot think of a greater privilege than serving in the House or the Senate. Now, as I've said after a long time, the presidency is the key office. What we've seen in the last 6 weeks, I think, indicates that the judgment of the president, his responsibility, his competence, his experience, his vigor, really, is going to decide whether we're going to live in peace, whether we're going to live in security. It's the president, not the House, not the Senate, or even the combination. This is the great office. Therefore, I run for the presidency because the same reason I ran for the House, because this is the place where the action is going to take place, affecting the lives of this, our people, and every people."
On Saturday, January 2nd, 1960, John F. Kennedy officially announced that he would be running for president. He stated that he wanted to provide, quote,
"a more vital life for our people and more freedom for people everywhere."
Jack Kennedy's campaign for presidency was a wholehearted, laser-focused, all-out effort by every member of the Kennedy clan. Ted Kennedy remembered that the family really knew 4 years prior. Quote,
"After the traditional Thanksgiving dinner in Hyannisport in November 1956, Jack and Joe Sr. left the table and repaired to the study near the living room for a private talk. When they emerged, grinning, arms around each other's shoulders, the rest of us learned that Jack had decided to run for president in 1960.
Ted Kennedy. Not everyone bought in on the Kennedy hype. When running for president of the free world, Jack was up against a lot of publicity that said his success as a congressman was due only to his dad's funding of his campaign and purchasing of PR rather than having to do with government or actual politics. The New York Post wrote,
"Month after month, from the glossy pages of Life to the multicolored cover of Red Book, Jack and Jackie smile out at millions of readers. He with his tousled hair and winning smile, she with her dark eyes and beautiful face. We hear of her pregnancy, of his wartime heroism, and of their fondness for sailing. But what has all this to do with statesmanship?"
And a columnist from the New York Times begged the question if
maybe there had been too much emphasis on how to win the presidency rather than on how to run it once he got there.
As he traveled the country, Jack worked on how to command a room with his speeches. Remember, he needed lots of practice on that. He practiced his timing and the art of spoken word at every event. An audience member and the chairman of the Democratic National Committee heard him speak in July 1959 and described him as, quote,
"certainly brilliant. His choice of topics, words, his fluency, all excellent. But his delivery took the cream off his own milk. Oh. He fairly rushes along, almost breathless, and his smiles are merely indicated, not given."
Jack wasn't the most gifted. But you know what beats talent every day of the week?
Hard work.
And Jack knew he could do that. And Bobby knew it too. He also knew, no matter how hard disheveled Jack worked, if he's going to be able to pull it off, he's going to need me. Bobby gave up his Senate staff job to once again become Jack's campaign manager and hit the ground running.
Because of course he did.
Oh, because he loved his brother.
He immediately called a meeting at his house in Hyannisport and asked Jack.
Jack, what has been done about the campaign? What planning has been done?
And before Jack could respond, Bobby continued.
Jack, how do you expect to run a successful campaign if you don't get started? A day lost now can't be picked up at the other end. It's ridiculous that more work hasn't been done already.
Jack had thought hard about this decision. He wasn't sure about running for the presidency until the last minute. But now, there were no more questions. This is go time. Jack set out on the open road to go shake hands with the people of America. His managers remembered it as a winter of, quote,
cold winds, cold towns, and many cold people.
Wait, I thought at this point he was already out there practicing his speeches.
Yes, it's all like a little convoluted and confusing because Ted says, oh, 4 years ago, we knew that Jack wanted to run. And they had like tentatively made that decision, but Jack was still not too sure. So he was out there practicing his speeches, even to keep the option open.
He just had to work ahead of himself. He hadn't fully committed to it yet,
though. Right. So mentally, he's just like, I don't know. And of course, we know Joe Sr. was pushing him hard the entire time. But now that the decision was for sure, he was on double time. So out on the road, Jack introduced himself to a couple of guys in a bar one time and told them that he was campaigning for presidency. One of them looked at him, replied,
president of what?
One cold and dark morning, Jack stood outside a meatpacking plant shaking workers' hands. One of his managers whispered to the other,
if I had his money, I'd be down there on the patio at Palm Beach.
The other replied,
God, if I had his medical problems and all the physical discomfort of the campaign adding to them.
Implying that he'd have given it up by now.
Yep.
But Jack was no quitter. And he was determined to make a difference in what ways he could. He was determined to use what his family had worked so hard for and go the distance. To make it all count. For Honey Fitz, and for Joe Sr., for Joe Jr., and for those who would never have the option available. For Ireland, for the farmers, and his ancestors who left it all behind. As much as it was up to him, he'd make it count.
In fact, the innately talented and successful had a responsibility to help them.
An elderly woman stopped Jack on the street during his campaign and said,
you're too soon, my boy. Too soon.
Jack replied,
no, this is my time. My time is now.
Jack knew that, yes, he was young for a presidential candidate. He also knew that whoever won the presidency would probably serve 2 terms, and in 8 years, his health would be worse than it was now, making campaigning even more of a stretch. If it was to be, it had to be now.
So eerie to think about what we talked about in KFM 10.
In context of this, Jack and Jackie went all across the U.S. to West Virginia, Nebraska, New York, Louisiana, Illinois, California, Oregon, Oklahoma, Delaware, Kansas, and Colorado. He spoke at fairgrounds, in theaters, on street corners, in airports, high schools, state capitals, restaurants, casinos, hotels, and convention halls. The Kennedy campaign for presidency, according to Pat Lucy, was, quote,
just an effective presentation of a celebrity. Genuinely glamorous, as well as glamorized, so the people were anxious to meet them wherever they went.
Jack, Bobby, Rose, and all the Kennedy sisters, along with Jackie, Janet, Lee, and if you remember from the Bouvier episodes, even Stosh Radziwill, were all out on the road. Early on, while working to win the primaries, the opposing candidate, Hubert Humphrey, concluded that he was just simply outmanned. Quote,
the Kennedys are all over the state,
he complained.
And they look alike and sound alike. Teddy or Eunice walks into a crowd wearing a raccoon coat and a stocking cap, and people think they're listening to Jack. I get reports that Jack is appearing in 3 or 4 different places at the same time.
This reminds me of what I think it was the nephew that said in the Ringling Brothers episode that it wasn't so much that they were super talented or super smart, just that there were so stinking many of them,
all focused on one goal. Here is Jean's perspective.
Eunice and Pat and I rented an apartment on Beacon Street and took a film around. People would call up and have 12 of their friends and get whomever they wanted, and then we'd show the film. Instead of getting too much into the nitty-gritty of the questions, because none of us were politically astute, we would say what he was like as a brother and things like that.
Aw.
And things as such.
Things as such.
They didn't all play the same role, though. Eunice did make speeches. Teddy managed the tour. Bobby managed everything. Jean showed up first and took careful notes on who was working. And Pat, well, Pat was the Hollywood sister. We have barely had a chance to talk about Patricia, and she has quite the story. So let's get to know her just a bit better real quick before we move on. We will do a deep dive and a whole dedicated episode to her and her husband, Peter, because
wow, are there some stories there?
Well, after she graduated from college, Pat worked for NBC in New York for a while. And then she moved to Los Angeles to work as an assistant for a radio program. She eventually took the role of the standing Western head of the Joseph P. Kennedy Foundation. Eunice had the East Coast, but Pat did not have anything near the relationship with the foundation that Eunice did. In 1949, Pat met a man who lived outside of the world of her brothers and sisters, but a man that starred in a world her father knew well. Hollywood. Peter Lawford was an actor. He was British. He was a member of Frank Sinatra's infamous Rat Pack. And Peter liked to have a good time.
I feel like I'm having character PTSD. A British Peter that lives to have fun? Sounds a little too familiar.
It's pretty freaking eerie, but I promise you, Pat's story is not going to end as badly as Kick's story. But yeah, this Peter Lawford, was also a wild choice. In the fall of 1956, Pat and Peter purchased a 10,000 square foot mansion. I was going to say home. Mansion. On the Pacific Coast Highway, and they bought it from the movie mogul Louis B. Mayer. You know that logo that plays before movies that has the roaring lion and it says MGM?
Yeah.
He is the second M in MGM. This house was to be the backdrop of some of the more questionable moments in American history. Namely, some of the more questionable moments in Kennedy history. You see, Pat and Peter served the Kennedy family in helping take the load off of Jack and Bobby's shoulders. They were the ones you went to have a bit too much fun and forget about your responsibilities. Forget that the entire country was counting on you. A number of women also used to be around, including one dame by the name
of Marilyn Monroe.
A friend who frequented the Santa Monica Lawford home said, quote,
"I used to pick these girls up. For a while, Jackie never came out here, and I thought maybe she was forbidden to come out."
Jack and Bobby's sister, your husband's sister, your sister-in-law, is like hosting these scandalous, scandalous weekends, and you're not allowed to go. We have an upcoming episode or a few episodes about this side of the Kennedys, this side of Jack. But just know that as Jack climbs the political ladder, this was Pat's silent assignment. This and all that came with it. Frank Sinatra lighting her clothes on fire, staying married to her cheating husband, even though she could never turn a blind eye to it as her mother had done. And always being there on the tarmac when Jack's private plane landed in Vegas and he needed his Hollywood sister. As the campaign progressed, the whole family watched the numbers. One night, while they were all gathered around for a new update, Eunice asked,
"What does it all mean?"
I can just like see her being so anxious, yeah. Like, "What's going on, Jack? Tell me." Jack replied,
"It means that we've got to go to West Virginia in the morning and do it all over again. And we've got to go to Maryland and to Indiana and Oregon and win all of them."
When strategizing the image they would be portraying, experts thought that Jackie's posh style might alienate voters and cause people to feel that they couldn't really relate to her or to Jack. But it actually had the opposite effect.
And that reminds me of when Jack was going to tell everyone about his illnesses.
Oh, yeah.
And they were all like, "Oh my God, they're going to think you're weak. It's going to be such a bad reaction."
When he was absent from the Senate for like a year and a half.
Yeah, and had back surgery and everything.
Mm-hmm.
And people actually had a positive reaction to it.
People actually connected with Jackie on an emotional level. She helped them feel permission to appreciate the beautiful and maybe frivolous things of life. She taught them that actually they are important.
Like we talked about in KFM 11, Jackie was definitely an Enneagram 4 because Cassie does the exact same thing for me.
What is mighty important?
Jackie gave them something to look up to. One man said,
"Now I believe in Santa Claus. She looks like a real queen."
Somehow, even in front of a huge crowd in her glamorous outfits, Jackie knew how to be approachable. She understood emotion, she understood people, and she met them where they were at.
"I have to confess,"
she said at a campaign once,
"I was born a Republican."
Much to Jackie's dismay, their daughter Caroline's 2-year-old vocabulary was formed out on the road, and her first words were
"plane," "goodbye,"
and
"New Hampshire."
That was so Jackie.
"I am so sorry so few states have primaries, or we would have a daughter with the greatest vocabulary of any 2-year-old in the country,"
Jackie lamented. I think she may have wanted to spend a little more time at home. Throughout the campaign for presidency, this was Kennedy's messaging.
"It is a time, in short, for a new generation of leadership. New men to cope with new problems and new opportunities. I stand tonight facing west on what was once the last frontier. From the lands that stretch 3,000 miles behind me, the pioneers of old gave up their safety, their comfort, and sometimes their lives to build a new world here in the West. They were not captives of their own doubts, the prisoners of their own price tags. Their motto was not every man for himself, but all for the common cause. We stand today on the edge of a new frontier, the frontier of the 1960s, a frontier of unknown opportunities and perils, a frontier of unfulfilled hopes and threats. Are we up to the task? Are we equal to the challenge?"
John F. Kennedy.
And the crowd goes wild.
During this time, the once calm and serene Hyannisport Kennedy compound was crawling with tourists and paparazzi.
Just how the Kennedys like it.
Jackie was 5 months pregnant with little John Jr., and Bobby was not joking around. He told a group of New York Democrats at the time,
"Gentlemen, I don't give a damn if the state and the county organizations survive after November, and I don't give a damn if you survive. I want to elect John F. Kennedy."
He was focused, and he needed everyone to realize that if this wasn't also their focus, their solitary focus, then there was no reason to be there. Staff members would whisper to each other,
"Little brother is watching you."
And one even nicknamed him
the Black Prince.
Eisenhower sometimes called him
Little Boy Blue,
and other times,
that little shit.
This reminds me of
Man is in the Forest
from the Disney episodes, because the Disney staff would whisper that to each other when Walt was coming in.
Someone has to keep everyone on task. Bobby knew how people felt, but it was a side consequence. It didn't really matter. It didn't affect his main goal at all. He was trying to help his big brother. Quote,
I'm not running a popularity contest. It doesn't matter if they like me or not. If people are not getting off their behind and working hard enough, how do you say that nicely? Every time you make a decision in this business, you make somebody mad.
Bobby Kennedy.
And that reminds me of Roy Disney, because they would call him the comptroller.
Mm-hmm. Oh, they called him the skinflint, too. And all he was ever trying to do
was help his brother
do what he was trying to do.
Quote, he seemed to have no interest at all in whether his efforts were approved or not by his classmates. He had a chip on his shoulder and a short fuse.
And that is historian Chris Matthews talking about Bobby in his school days, because he was the same the entire time. If something was right and he felt he needed to do it, he didn't look around for people's approval. This allowed his big brother, Jack, to be the good cop. And big brother charmed the socks off of all of them. This is Eleanor Roosevelt on Jack as a candidate.
Here was a man who could learn. I liked him better than I ever had before because he seemed so little cocksure, and I think he has a mind that is open to new ideas. My final judgment is that here is a man who wants to leave a record, perhaps for ambitious personal reasons, as people say, but I rather think because he is really interested in helping the people of his own country and mankind in general. I will be sure of this as time goes on, but I think I am not mistaken in feeling that he would make a good president if elected.
Cassie and I just did mini-sodes on the Kennedys and Roosevelts because they have a long history together.
Yes, I wrote this script before that mini-sode, and it's really interesting seeing this quote now, knowing more about Eleanor Roosevelt and more about what she thought about Jack Kennedy. A few people didn't love him. President Truman once said of Jack, quote,
I never liked Kennedy. I hate his father. Kennedy wasn't so great as a senator. However, that no good son of a dick Nixon called me a communist, and I'll do anything to beat him.
And so he decided to back Jack as well. By the end of August 1960, before the November election, Nixon and Kennedy were locked in a dead even match in the polls. It may have been less that people couldn't decide which one they would rather have as their president, but rather which one they would like as their president the least so that they could vote for the other. Nixon's reputation of being incredibly biased and Kennedy's young age and Catholic religion made Americans unenthusiastic about either one of them. Rumors about Jack's character started to come out in the press, and when Bobby heard, he exploded out of his office screaming and demanding that everyone be on the road tomorrow morning for Operation
Counterattack Sourcebook.
They were going to go out and answer people's questions head on about religion, health, or lack thereof, inexperience, and civil rights. Jack would be the youngest person to ever be elected president if he won. While we're on the subject, we have to talk about civil rights. And we are going to talk a lot about civil rights. But for today, John F. Kennedy saw the very obvious moral issue at hand. He spoke at black conventions, criticized Eisenhower for not desegregating the public buildings, sponsored a national conference on civil rights, and promised to take action on a, quote,
bold and large scale
leading up to the election. But he was also human and was afraid of losing votes. So John Fitzgerald Kennedy wasn't the greatest ally either. The biggest opportunity for Jack to show his true colors in the support of black rights came when Martin Luther King Jr. was thrown in prison. He was arrested for trying to integrate a restaurant in an Atlanta department store. The rest of the protesters involved were released shortly after, but as you would expect from Georgia police in 1960, they threw a traffic violation at King so that they could keep him locked up. Quote,
We must prepare ourselves for the fact that I am going to have to serve this time.
Martin Luther King Jr. told his father. Then, at 3 o'clock in the morning, they barged into his cell, woke him up, and shipped him 200 miles away to a hard labor prison in rural Georgia. His wife, Coretta, was terrified that he may be killed while in prison, and she was 5 months pregnant at the time.
It's like what Cassie pointed out in Jackie's episode about the sacrifice that it takes from all sides.
So in her distress, Coretta called Harris Wofford. He was the Kennedy administration's civil rights expert and an ally of Martin Luther King Jr. So Coretta called him panicked and begging for help and was quoted saying,
"They are going to kill him. I know they are going to kill him."
So Wofford immediately called Sergeant Shriver, Eunice's husband, who then told Jack to call Mrs. King back. It was 2 weeks prior to the election, so it might have been partly for a political statement, of course, but also it was partly from a genuine desire to help the Kings. Sarge told Jack,
"Why don't you telephone Mrs. King and give her your sympathy? Negroes don't expect everything will change tomorrow, no matter who's elected, but they will want to know whether you care. If you telephone Mrs. King, they'll know you understand and will help. You'll reach their hearts and give support to a pregnant woman now afraid her husband will be killed." "Good idea," Jack said. "Why not? Do you have her number? Get her on the phone."
Later, Mrs. King remembered Jack's words to her.
"I want to express my concern about your husband. I know this must be very hard on you. I understand you're expecting a baby, and I just wanted you to know that I was thinking about you and Dr. King. If there is anything I can do to help, please feel free to call me."
Bobby was livid. He was worried that Jack's name being involved would risk losing in three southern states that might single-handedly decide the entire election that was just 2 weeks away. And then what could he do for Black America? It was overwhelming. But this is Bobby Kennedy we're talking about. Though he was in charge of the campaign and felt an almost sole responsibility for successfully electing his brother to the presidency, this is Bobby, Robert Francis Kennedy. He was more outraged about the injustice of King's sentence and may or may not have called the judge a
bastard
and
that son of a bitch.
So he picked up the phone, called the judge, and freed Dr. King. Like that. Bobby's phone call freed Martin Luther King Jr. from prison on Wednesday, October 26th, 1960. And in contrast to what they thought may happen and were willing to give up anyway, the Kennedys stepping up and Nixon doing absolutely nothing gained a ton of support for the upcoming election. Maybe even enough to counteract the loss of support in those three southern states they were worried about. Because, according to historians, the Kennedy campaign got enough support from Black America to possibly have swung five states.
What a risk.
It's not for sure, but it's concluded from the events that Delaware, Illinois, Michigan, New Jersey, and South Carolina all swung to Kennedy's side. And every vote from every freaking state mattered in that 1960 election. The other elephant in the room were the tons of whispers swarming around about Jack's affairs. But this one, they didn't address. No one of note was really speaking out about it, so why validate a silly rumor? The FBI even had an entire file of evidence of Jack's affairs, but didn't really do anything with it. 35 different reporters had sent copies of letters and photographs to the FBI, and allegedly they had substantial information about an illicit affair of his with another man's wife during World War II. But not a single one of those 35 reporters mentioned in the FBI file ever published a story about Jack's affairs. There were also reports that a Miami flight attendant had been sent to visit Senator Kennedy and that there were photos of him leaving a glamorous female employee's house at 1 o'clock in the morning.
Isn't it a bit sus that we still have never seen these photos?
The reason that no one called it out may have been because they didn't have enough confirmation of these rumors. Or it could have been because most of them, meaning the reporters and the other higher-up politicians that could have called them out about it, were also doing the exact same thing through the 1950s and 60s. And so they were afraid that if they called it out in Jack, it would bring scrutiny upon themselves. And speaking of the FBI, there were also files stating that mob members who were connected to Frank Sinatra were financially supporting the Kennedys' campaign for president. But we will get more into that in Pat's episode. And now we get to a classic, quintessential moment in history. And my husband's actually the one who initially told me this story because I either did not learn about it in school or I just completely forgot about it because I didn't really care about the Kennedys back then. But the Nixon-Kennedy debate was the first presidential debate to be televised. We know this. But it was also still broadcast on radio, and there were still a large number of people who tuned in this way. And this is the wild part. The people who listened on the radio thought that Nixon won the debate. But the people who watched the video footage on national television believed that Kennedy won. Nixon, during the debate, was super sweaty and anxious acting. He was half hunched over and he seemed honestly neurotic. Kennedy was standing up straight, shoulders back, calm, collected, and looked much more confidently in control.
I'm going to link this debate video on Patreon because it's fascinating to watch. And then I'm also going to link the At Home with the Kennedys video as well. So be looking out for that.
Of course, Jack prepped for this. The day before, he had met with television producers and discussed camera angles, but that was really the least of it. The Kennedys were always focused on the future, in a similar way to the way that Walt Disney was always embracing new technology and was always ahead of culture. Just one step, and that's all you've got to be. Joe Kennedy had purchased video cameras the second that they were available to have at home, and he stuck them right in all of his kids' faces. Not just in like an adoring, fatherly, oh my gosh, my kids are so cute way. More like, everyone listen up. These are video cameras. You will get comfortable being in front of them to the point that you master them, and you'll wield their power before anyone else will have even thought to do so. When we're done here, the camera will be your childhood best friend, and when someone else sticks one in your face when you're 43 years old, the warmth of your familiarity with the camera will come straight through the lens and captivate America so that you can be president.
Nothing is an accident. JFK was decades in the making.
When Mayor Daley saw the debate on TV, he said,
"My God, they've embalmed him before he even died."
Nixon refused to wear makeup and he was suffering from a knee injury. So he looked super washed out and uncomfortable, shifting back and forth from leg to leg the whole time, making him look incredibly nervous. He was wearing a light gray suit that showed up blurred and basically just made him look like a big gray blob on the 1960s television. On the other hand, you know how much Jack loved to have a tan. So even though his injuries were hurting him much worse than Nixon's were, he appeared glowing and full of life. He wore a navy blue suit to create a sharp contrast against the gray background in the studio. And so all things working together, he looked about 30 to 40 years younger than Nixon when they were shown side by side.
Another way that Jack's life had prepared him for this moment was that Jack was well-versed in smiling through the pain.
And then, to top it all off, Nixon walked up to Jack at the end of the debate and poked him in the chest and was saying something to him, thinking he would look like he was in the power position on camera, but instead he ended up just looking like a bully. Jack looked in control. He looked sure. He looked like a leader. At least 4 million new votes were convinced from the televised debate. And according to An Unfinished Life, John F. Kennedy by Robert Dallek, allegedly, someone in the Nixon camp broke into two of Jack's doctor's offices in New York and were trying to build evidence that Jack couldn't physically handle the presidency. Some people think that it was a response to how Nixon looked at the debate. He needed to make Jack's illnesses known to make his apparent weakness less of a contrast.
Well, we know what happens later with the Watergate scandal, so probably was him.
Quote,
I'm not satisfied until every American enjoys his full constitutional rights.
The night before the election, Jack gave a speech in Boston and opened with, quote,
I would like to have you meet my two sisters and sister-in-law who have, together in the last 2 months, campaigned in over 40 states, and since we started in the primaries in January, have spent far more time away from home than at home. My sister, Patricia Lawford from California.
Crowd cheers loudly.
And her husband, Peter Lawford.
Crowd goes absolutely berserk. You would have thought that Elvis had made a surprise appearance. After several seconds, Jack threw a glowing smile.
Peter, you're very big in Boston. My sister, Eunice Shriver from Illinois, and the wife of my brother, Teddy, who's our Western manager, this is Joan Kennedy. I come here to Boston, which my grandfather represented 60 years ago, and which I had the honor of representing 14 years ago when I was first elected to the House of Representatives.
Man, we are really flying through this timeline. Episode 10 was 14 years ago.
Honestly.
I have therefore proudly come back to this spot and ask your help tonight to be elected President of the United States.
Applause.
This race is a contest between the comfortable and the concerned. Between those who believe that we should rest and lie at anchor and drift. And between those who want to move this country forward in the 1960s.
That's the whole gist of this speech. Well, that's the whole gist of the Kennedys. Are we going to step up or not?
Jack had decided once again it was time to write to the obituary on the past.
The next president of the United States, on his shoulders, will rest burdens heavier than have rested on the shoulders of any president since the time of Lincoln.
Chills. Oh my gosh.
Why am I going to cry? Anyone listen to KFM 10?
Anyone listen to KFM 1?
Anyone listen to this whole freaking thing? And then he goes on to list the issues that he cares about, the things that need to change.
War and peace, the progress of this country, the security of our people, the education of our children, jobs for men and women who want to work, the development of our resources, the symbolic feeling of a nation, the image the nation presents to the world, its power, prestige, and direction, all ultimately will come to rest on the next president of the United States.
Applause.
This is the most responsible time in the life of any citizens of any free country, and I do not run for the office of the presidency after 14 years in the Congress with any expectation that it is an empty or easy job. All of us know the truth, and no amount of executive secrecy can hide it. We know that we are not as secure as we were a decade ago or even 5 years ago. We know that there are great motions at work in the world which have not always reckoned with the position of the United States.
The freedom of democracy was being threatened, and it was, while JFK served as president, the most dangerous moment for America in all of history.
I want them to be convinced that we are at work in this society as a serious, determined people, building in the United States the kind of society which can serve as an example to all those who wish to be free. That is the opportunity before us in the 60s. To be the great defender of freedom in a time when freedom is under attack and under test all over the globe. Thomas Paine said in the American Revolution, "The cause of America is the cause of all mankind." And now, in the revolution of the 1960s, the cause of all mankind is the cause of America.
This next thing Jack says, this comes from the gut. This comes from personal experience. With war, with evil, with Hitler.
Who can be so ill-informed that he thinks the tensions of the power struggle disappear by goodwill missions, by debates, and by arguments? They will disappear or they will be overcome only by what we do here. The Vice President of the United States says that he will go to Eastern Europe when he wins this election. I will go to Washington, D.C.
Applause.
For here is where the job must be done. The kind of society we build, the kind of power we generate, the kind of enthusiasm that we incite, all this will tell whether, in the long run, darkness or light overtakes the world. I welcome the opportunity to be engaged in this struggle as the chief arm of freedom.
On November 8, 1960, John Fitzgerald Kennedy was elected to be the president of the United States in one of the closest elections in history. So close that it took a very long time into the wee hours of the morning to get the results back, and one John Fitzgerald Kennedy had retired to his bed. So the rest of the Kennedy family were on patrol, stayed up, waited to see the results, and when he awoke in the morning, he was the next president of the United States. In the popular vote, he won, but barely. I've seen quotes that Kennedy had from 113 to 118,000 more votes than Nixon out of the 69 million votes cast. That means that he won by a margin of around 0.17%. So not even 2%.
Oh my gosh.
He was also the youngest man ever elected to president of the United States and the first Catholic to be elected and the first ever president born in the 20th century. Two of those things they had to address leading up to the vote. If you think about it, the United States was quite literally founded by people running away from Catholicism. They created an entire new country to be able to escape the religious oppression from their old Catholic monarchy. Trusting that someone belonging to the Catholic Church would be able to rule for the people outside of religious opinion and not from a devotion to the church was a big ask. In fact, in 1956, just 4 years earlier, 25% of American voters said that they were unwilling to vote for any Catholic candidate, regardless of who the candidate was. In the 1950s, Catholics were literally seen as un-American. Protestants were American. According to historian Timothy Neftali, all of the Kennedy advisors begged Bobby and Jack not to address his Catholicism at all. They said, "You're making religion an issue, doing what the bigots want you to do, talking about it, reminding everyone of your allegiance to the Catholic Church." This is what Jack said on national television.
"So it is apparently necessary for me to state once again not what kind of church I believe in, for that should be important only to me, but what kind of America I believe in. I believe in an America where the separation of church and state is absolute. And this is the kind of America that I fought for in the South Pacific and the kind my brother died for in Europe. No one suggested then that we might have a divided loyalty, that we did not believe in liberty, or that we belonged to a disloyal group that threatened, I quote, the freedom for which our forefathers died. So I want you to know that I'm grateful to you for inviting me tonight. I'm sure that I have made no converts to my church, but I do hope."
Pause for laughter.
"I do hope that at least my view, which I believe to be the view of my fellow Catholics who hold office, I hope that it may be of some value and at least assisting you to make a careful judgment."
Well, that's that, isn't it?
Quote.
He was making sort of a moral, ethical argument about what it means to be an American. And he said, "We would hate to have a country that millions of people who, on the day they're baptized, are told that they can't be president of the United States."
Kathleen, not Kick, Kennedy. Bobby and Ethel's firstborn. His wife, however, had a different take on the topic.
I think it's so unfair of people to be against Jack because he's a Catholic. He's such a poor Catholic. Now, if it were Bobby, I could understand it.
Jackie Kennedy. Some could look upon this new president-elect and assess that he knew nothing of margins, nothing of being the forgotten underdog. But that's only what he wanted them to think. What was true was that he was the sick boy, never to be counted. He was the average talent, the 65th in a class of 110. He was the skeletal big brother of a girl with intellectual disabilities in whom the world did not see value. He was the lonely boy who got the least of his mother, and in his father's eyes, merely the shadow behind his golden big brother. He was the only PT commander struck in the South Pacific, and the only original Kennedy kid left standing. He was the man who smiled through excruciating pain half of the days that he lived. And yet, with every hit, he wills himself upright, back on his feet, grits his teeth, and uses his hands to swing one foot in front of the other. You could say he was the least qualified. You could say he was the best qualified.
I have traveled this country from one end to another. I have spent many days in nearly every state, and I come back to Boston, Massachusetts, with a stronger feeling of confidence, of hope, of knowledge of the vitality and energy of this society and our people than I could have ever had before. It is the best education for a candidate for the presidency. All the criticisms that are leveled at presidential campaigns, in my judgment, fade away against the knowledge which a potential president may have of the strength of his society, of ours, and our people. So I come here tonight. I thank you for your past support. I ask you to join us tomorrow. And most of all, I ask you to join us in all the tomorrows yet to come, in building America, moving America, picking this country of ours up, and sending it into the 60s.
They were at the helm during the most turbulent moment in American history. The rumors are legion. Some sincere, some slander. They gave everything to their country. But what did it look like behind closed doors? In their homes? The most intimate moments of their time on Earth. Sometimes the truth is more wild than the headlines. They seemed to live the easy life, but they lost it all in an instant. They ran faster, worked harder, burned brighter, and then they were gone. You have just listened to The Kennedy Siblings, episode 12 from Blood and Business.
Thank you all for listening to today's episode. If you enjoyed it, please give us a review on Apple, rate us on Spotify, and share Blood and Business with a friend or a sibling. If you'd like to support the show, the best way is to become a patron of Blood and Business. You will get bonus content every month, including a monthly bonus episode, interactive main episodes, and behind-the-scenes footage.
To keep up with us day-to-day, you can follow us at Blood and Business on Instagram and TikTok. You can find the link for Instagram, TikTok, and Patreon in the show notes below. Thank you so much for the support, and we will see you back here next week for your regularly scheduled programming on
Blood and Business.
The main sources for this episode were An Unfinished Life, John F. Kennedy, by Robert Dalek, and The Kennedy Women, by Lawrence Lehmer.
To see a complete list of sources for all Blood and Business episodes, head on over to Patreon for a free PDF download.